The perspective of this talk is more coming at it, things from a researcher's point of view than a commercial point of view, though it does obviously mostly draw on commercial experiences. So we'd had this tool in academia. It worked pretty good. We'd shove Linux through it or BSD through it, count up bugs, publish papers. Things seemed to be going fairly well, and so my students decided they wanted to make money instead of get tenure, so they went off to start a company. And we had all these ideas about what the big problems would be, and it was always like more analysis or, oh, the crazy false positives. And it turned out that all the things that were first order were just completely bizarre. We never would have imagined. And you would tell it to your friends, and looking at you like, yeah, whatever, that can't be the problem. So this is just sort of going back and pulling out some of the more interesting ones. Sometimes they're interesting in a very sad way, because you'd prefer not having smart people think about them. But there you are. So that was a pretty comprehensive bio. I'll only note a couple things. So my PhD was in the bug generation business. The generation method of choice was you'd usually crash something in your kernel, and your LED lights would all go green or red, or they'd flash in some way. You try to figure out what's going on. And as you can imagine, that's not very much fun. It was also really hard. And so since then, we've mostly been finding bugs, which turns out to be very easy in comparison to writing real code. And while this talk is mostly about just about static analysis plus some social issues. The research we do is pretty promiscuous in terms of techniques. So we're not a static analysis shop, though the company is. So anything that works is good. So this range from static analysis, which we'll talk about, to implementation level model checking, which I won't, and symbolic execution, which I also won't. And actually, all of my current work is all dynamic. Though, unfortunately, if you look back at the static stuff, if you look at those papers, the bug counts in those papers always have a couple extra zeros after the numbers, which is still a source of frustration, but hopefully we'll fix that at some point. So the talk is just experiences from Coverity. These numbers are out of date. So right now there's roughly around 500 customers, roughly around 130 employees. So for a software tools company, it's doing fairly well. For a real company like Google, it's not, you know, it's a micro whatever, none of your choice, very, very small. So this talk is not so much that this is the one true way that you should follow and things will work out great, because there's probably at least 10x still left on the table from what we did. But this is, we went about things in a reasonably pragmatic way. We didn't particularly have religion. We wanted a lot of results, and we didn't really care how we got it. And then these are the weird things that we had to deal with. So I'm probably going to be true for most companies, because we had fairly low bars in terms of what we needed. One big caveat, though, is that I have a day job, which is not at this company. So it's my students that are running everything and doing all the interesting work. So I'm just sort of a voyeur, and I'm just reporting on random bits of gossip that I get from them. So this is very much not my name is at the end of this slide, not by chance. And if you know anything about professors, you know that that's an unusual location. Anyway, so there'll be a bunch of different stories. I'll try to keep them somewhat short so you can phase in and out, as I do in big talks or long talks. But there's two basic plot lines. One is that you have a lot of fun with normal distributions. So when you run things in your lab, you'll run it on like one or two code bases, and you know you'll make it work really well in those one or two code bases. And then you go out and you try to scale things up to like 1,000 companies, and suddenly you get a normal distribution. And once you get that, you get things that are 6 standard deviation from the mean in terms of IQ, in terms of code quality, in terms of weird constructs they claim are C and actually are not C, how much they care about bugs. And these 6 standard Ds become fairly common. There'll be some sort of thing like it at each different company you have, and you have to deal with them instead of playing in your nice little average place. The other is that there's a fairly vicious interplay between the social and the technical. Often there'll be some technical problem has a very simple, maybe even trivial technical solution. But because of social constraints, you can't do that, and you have to do some weird Rube Goldberg-type way of trying to get at things just because of that. So, for instance, you know, it's mostly about no's. So you can't touch the build, you can't touch the source, you can't reject code that's not C even if it isn't C. People will not understand your tool. Anything they don't understand is your fault. It's not a bug, it's now a false positive. And there's a fairly long litany of these which we will get at. But get used to frowny faces if you want cash. Okay, so one slide of context, and then we'll sort of, well, technical context, just to sort of get it at how we're playing the game. So the way we were coming at it, there's lots of different ways to do this. This is just, I'm just saying our way so you have some notion. Are you getting, is this very sibilant? Sounds kind of annoying. So our view is if you crack open a big system, there's all these ad hoc correctness rules. Their common features are they're fairly simple sentence clauses. If you call lock, you better call unlock. If you free memory, you better not use it afterwards. And the other commonality they had was that you had to obey them everywhere all the time, and one error would crash your system. And depending on the system, that could be pretty bad. So the cornerstone of our approach, and basically the cornerstone of any static analysis approach, is that a lot of these times these rules map to fairly simple, fairly clearly to source constructs. So you teach your compiler, your tool, about these code constructs, and it can check these abstract rules. So a really trivial one, in Linux, you have lock kernel that has to be paired with unlock kernel. So you can tell, you can have a little, the way we played the game was we had a little front end. For every little one of these rules you had, you would write a little compiler extension or parameterize an existing one. We'd jam it in this compiler, and it would then get to go down all paths in a flow-sensitive, path-sensitive, and interprocedural manner throughout the code. So this is not like grep. This is, you're trying to get deeply as you can into the semantics of what's going on so you can find when it makes no sense whatsoever. So as an example, here if we're checking locks, first path through, they say a lock kernel. If this if statement fails, there's an unlock kernel. We're happy campers. In this case, they do lock kernel. If this if statement succeeds, they then return without locking the kernel. Now your kernel's locked up some amount of time later, which is going to be weird. Okay, so when you can play the game, there's a couple nice things. You can't always. This works very well if the rule's visible in the source code. So if you can look at the source code and you can see if they're obeying the rule or not, you can probably get a compiler to play. If you're trying to check some property implied by the source code, like I run this routing algorithm 1,000 times and suddenly I get a loop, you're probably not going to get that with static. You probably need some sort of dynamic approach. But when you can do static, there's a couple of nice things. One is that it scales pretty well. So if you think about it, once you pay the fixed cost of writing this checker, it doesn't really matter if we shove 10 lines of code through or 10 million lines of code through. The incremental cost is you wait longer, and you inspect more bugs. But it's not like you have to go annotate stuff, write more test cases, all this other kind of thing. The other nice thing about static is that it's very precise. So if you think about what happened to you if you hit this bug, there's actually very few people probably in this building that could diagnose it. I mean, you would be running your kernel, it would lock up, you'd get maybe a backtrace. But most errors lead to lockup and backtrace. So it's really hard to invert this output to get back to the input that, and the function that led to it. Whereas what the static checker can do is say, look, you know, you acquire this lock and you didn't release it. Go fix it. And suddenly, you know, there's almost no one that can code that couldn't go do this. And we've actually empirically validated this by having Stanford undergrads eat a bunch of output from these tools and go submit kernel patches. And if you've met Stanford undergrads recently, you realize this must be pretty simple. maybe professors too. And the really important thing, or the only reason this is at all interesting, is it works pretty well. You know, if you take a large system that's a million lines of code, and you take a decent tool, ours, someone else's, and and the system's never been checked, if you don't find 1,000 errors or you know, in that ballpark, something's weird. You know, you didn't configure your tool, something's wrong. You know, you immediately your knee jerk is to go look at that. And this is the nice thing about this compared to the techniques I work on now. Which I look back very wistfully for this one, is that, like usual, you really care about how big the source code is. But this is this is about the only technique I can think of where you really like it if the code is big, because you know you're gonna get huge numbers of errors. People will be impressed. They'll be like fire. Most other techniques, big is like really bad. And you immediately strip it down to like the traveling salesman problem or something, and then you make a lot of arguments for why that's not stupid, which no one believes. All right. So HiBit works pretty well. We generated a lot of papers. I got tenure. Students got PhDs. Coverity had enough money that they have a marketing department, which I will prove with a couple slides. It'll be obvious they're not my slides. I'm mostly doing this just so you can see sort of where the data comes from and also the sort of story that you can settle on when you started. So one thing is, as academics, it wasn't really clear to us how to sell a tool. Like, especially, this was, you know, early 2000s, you'd go talk to VCs and they'd be like, oh, tools. Yeah, tools are hard. You know, maybe come back if you can do some sort of, you know, pet food store or something online. No one's impressed with tools. And so it was actually, in retrospect, maybe it seems clear to everyone but us, but at the time it was very puzzling how to go about this. Everybody said that, you know, you had to go and you had to get the CEO to cram this down everyone's throat because there was no other way that would do it, or various other ways to do things. But it turns out, as probably many people already know, surprisingly, actually, a straight technology sell actually does work. So the way we came in, which will determine a lot of the technical stuff I'll talk about later because of the requirements it placed, was you wanted any random developer to be able to call in our company, do a trial, and then look at the errors and try to make some sort of sale out of that. So the as you can see from the story, this is what you would expect. Software, we're going to try to find all the bugs. It's getting really complicated, and it's getting worse over time. And then the other thing which people seem to buy into is, not only is it getting bigger, but it's coming from a lot of places you don't trust. By God, you must have some way to get a handle on that. That actually seems to work pretty well. So this is a pretty dated slide. So started out, I think it was Ben and Seth sleeping on the floor, and they sort of had one customer, sort of. And then after that, Andy joined and another guy, and then things scaled up. So now customers should be around 500-ish. Again, employees should be around 130-ish. One thing you can see is the ratios. So initially they were pretty bad. It looks like we're settling around three and a half customers per employee, which is not so great. So that tells you some dynamics about the business. It's not a Google where you can ship a web page to a billion people and make lots of happy things. This is still fairly service intensive. The one unfortunate dynamic with most tools is it seems you have to be able. Well, one, you have to set it up. And getting people to set things up themselves it turns out to be fairly complicated. And you also have to explain what the hell's going on. Because if they don't understand it, it's just discarded as useless. And unfortunately, one of the dynamics that happens is anytime your tool does something interesting, you call some complicated routine in your tool, you're going to have to, and it does some useful technique to discover an error, you're going to have to articulate what that thing did to the user so that they can understand why they should believe this is an error. So it really puts a harsh limit on how complicated you can do things. And if you're right at the border, you really have to be there to explain, at least for us. Probably maybe other people that are more clever can figure out a way to do this by just shipping boxes. So currently there's 1 billion lines of code that's licensed plus. And since all places they do trials at don't succeed, that's where the few billion came from. But there's a fair amount of code that's been jammed through the thing. Okay, so the main verb of the whole system is the trial process. There's other important verbs, too. Like on an ongoing basis, you better be finding good bugs. People must not be getting pissed off. But if you can't get the trial to work, you can't make any sale, and nothing really matters at that point. So this is the thing that distorts the technological fabric of the company the most. And the way that this gets played... as you can see, this is marketing. I'm not even sure what some of these bullets mean. But the main thing that happens is there'll be a sales guy and someone who's called a sales engineer, who's someone who doesn't really like coding that much anymore. And they'll get shipped to a company, and then they show up, and in that morning they have to run on some large code base, ideally a huge code base that they've never seen before, and get a lot of good errors out, and with a small break in between, then go and describe things to a meeting of people that are maybe somewhat hostile. Or, there'll be some interested people, some non-interested people. And this is your basic dynamic. So what this means, and again, this is just how we did it. Other people can probably be successful or even more successful and do it a different way. This is our requirements. You have to be able to do this sort of setup and run within a day, ideally. Ideally, you run in the morning, you present in the afternoon, so you get in and out. Because the more sales opportunities a sales guy can support, the farther they go, and they're fairly expensive. Currently, for us, the number's around 40 sales opportunities a year is how they measure things, partly because we have to do this trial thing. So what this means is that your error reports better be good. So what you're going to do is you're going to get a whole bunch of errors for a system you don't understand, and you have to describe them to people who wrote the code about why you believe this is a valid error. So it's got to be very, very quick. And setup has to be easy because, again, they won't help you run. If you have to touch anything, they don't like it. And if there's anyone who actually understands how to build the system, they're probably really important, and they're probably not there when you are because they're running around like crazy. You also can't have any false positives because there's not much time to, sift through things and then cherry-pick out the true bugs. And you also should be finding pretty good bugs right up front because there's not much time, again, to cherry-pick the results you have. So these are fairly stringent requirements that has a daily impact on how things get done. It does mean that the tool you produce is fairly low in terms of bullshit, which is kind of nice. There's not a lot of smoke and mirrors. It's constantly being tested by a normal distribution of your sales guys. So the worst sales guy still has to be able to make quota on a regular basis using your tool. And that's a pretty strong test, actually. So I had some friends, or one person I know reasonably well, in the mid-90s who did a software tools company, and there's some parallels in how we do things from them. We ideally try to steal from people as much as possible. So Intrinsa was around in the mid-90s, and the way they did it was they would come in, and you pay them $5,000, they would do a trial, and if you didn't like it, you get the results back. It turned out that from our sales guys that it's better just to charge zero, because that means anyone can bring you in. You say, look, you just bring us in, we'll run, you like the results, you buy. If not, we go away. You don't need any signature authority for anything. That was a big deal. And it turns out that actually, in the VP's view, even if we charge $20,000 or so, it still wouldn't be worth it, because it adds so much time, you just burn a lot of resources. It's one really nice thing is it filters out, it sort of keeps support costs low, in the sense that the only way we could make a sale to any customer is if this stuff went pretty smoothly. So if it doesn't, they're going to say, go away, you know, don't bother us. So the residue you have left that actually wrote you a check are people you're actually able to deal with their source code basis, whatever stage your tool is in. So this is actually really nice. Support over a phone is amazingly difficult. I don't understand how these people make things work. And the big con for us, which is probably the first order limit on how big the company can get, is that you must ship a sales engineer and a sales guy, and they have to be competent. So if you have a tools company... I'm sorry?
Be careful of the word con. It has too many different meanings.
Yeah, well, no, this is... They were not unintended. So, yeah, sales guy. Though, just to pull things up a little early, please interrupt at any moment. It gets much more interesting if it's a dialogue. My monologues tend to be, what they are. You probably want something different, especially if I'm saying something you don't believe, because either I'm not being honest or I'm just being unclear. Hopefully it's the latter, but we can sort things out. One thing I didn't expect, so I came from MIT where we were hardcore, you know, sales guys suck, you know, money sucks, you suck, you know, what I did yesterday sucks, everything sucks. And one thing that was shocking was, actually, now I kind of like sales guys, because the great thing about them is they're so easy to evaluate. So you think about an engineer, like you hire someone, you're like a manager, or you're busy. And so you have some programmer go hack on something for you. And let's say it takes them, they're, you know, 6 months later, they're not done. Well, it could be that they're not very good. Or it could be that, you know, you're just high level, you're a little vapid now, you're not quite as sharp as you used to be, and you didn't understand the problem. And you're not really sure which one of these are. Sometimes you're very sure. But often you're not quite sure which one of these problems it is. And so you give them a little bit more rope, and eventually maybe you do fire them. But then they sort of messed up everything up, and bringing someone in to fix the mess is kind of a problem. Whereas a sales guy, it's, you know, this is like a small baby evaluates them. You know, did you make your X million-dollar quota or not? You know, above bar, this is fantastic. Here's a bonus. Below bar, you know, we need the desk for someone else. And it's very unambiguous, and it's very simple. And everybody understands it, and so people's feelings don't really get hurt. And it's surprisingly how much easier it is to deal with these guys. Plus, they actually tend to be fairly optimistic people, which, yes, exactly. Yeah, not enough of those. All right, so that's a bit of the context. If things are unclear later, please do interrupt. And we'll get back at some stuff. Okay, so now we'll actually transition to some of the things that surprised us. So our naive view, which you will see is obviously stupid, we're in school, we run on Linux and BSD, we find enough bugs, we get into good conferences, everybody's sort of happy. We're thinking, oh, we just need some sort of pretty box and we're going to be done. And this is obviously retarded. But it's not quite for the reasons that you might think. And it looks like one of the reasons for this is that in the lab, even if you're checking one or two big things, so you have a tool that actually is pretty good. I mean, it actually can work with real source code, and it actually does find good stuff, as many people here have built. Even if it's pretty big, it's still pretty monoculturalish. I mean, you're still dealing with Linux or BSD, and it's, you know, yeah, there's thousands of people hacking on it, but, you know, really, it sort of looks all sort of alike, actually. Surprisingly. And in reality, you're going to go and check many things which are independently built. This forms a normal distribution, and the mass of that normal distribution is not going to be on those little dots that you were focusing on. It's all over the place. And so you're going to run into some pretty weird things where you're not happy. Okay. So we're checking code. So the first law of checking, the first fundamental law you might think, is that if you don't check something, you don't find any bug. And it turns out that there's two even more basic laws that you never would have guessed it mattered. The first law really is that you can't check code you can't see. This is sort of, you know, your checker doesn't run very interestingly on epsilon. And this seems kind of not very interesting. It's like, you know, I can't check something if my computer runs out of zeros. And it's just, yeah, whatever. But it turns out this is actually kind of a real problem. It won't be a problem at first. You'll be able to make some progress, like, you know, 4 or 5 customers. And then you're going to, at least we run into some issues. So the first thing, which, of course, you would never do, but just as a straw man, you know, I got to find all the code I want to check. Well, I could just do, like, find, you know, start at C on the subdirectory. So, of course, you get all sorts of nonsense that's not interesting. You don't even know the command lines. You don't know the configuration. So, of course, no one really does this. What they do is maybe you replace the compiler. You know, so I'll replace the compiler and user bin with my little compiler, or I'll hack the make file. And it's like, yeah, right. You can get 2 people that will let you do that, and they probably don't have much money. So that doesn't work very well. So the next thing you do, which actually is not quite as stupid as those, is we'll just run make. We'll grab the output, and you just walk over the output. Every place you see GCC, you put in your little tool name, and then you just replay everything. And the good thing about make is that it'll tell you exactly where it's at, so you know sort of where in the directory tree you're at and what the command line arguments were. And this will work actually pretty well for like 4 or 5 more customers. And then you run into this question. And you say, well, they say, how do we run your tool? We say, oh, you just do make, and we'll handle everything. And they're like, make? You know, we use ClearCase. They're like, ClearCase? What the hell is that? So that's, you know, that's a chasm you don't cross. You skip them. then you go to another large company. You know, you're salivating. You know, at this point, you know, 3 million lines of code to you is a big deal. And no matter what you do, you only see 10,000 lines of code. You don't know what the hell's going on. It turns out if you look at the build system, actually, they kick off a build that calls a Perl script, which calls this other Perl script, which calls this weird compiler you've never heard of, and does all these things that you don't see if you do this sort of simple thing. So you start doing Band-Aids, you know, 1 Band-Aid per customer. And then one of your favorite customers ever calls you with this sort of weird support call where he's on the phone and he's like, you know, whenever I run your tool, you know, I have to reinstall my entire machine from the OS distribution and then copy all my old stuff over. You know, is this normal? It's like, well, I guess for you it's typical, but no, it's not supposed to be normal. So it turns out what was happening here was we were running make. They had some slightly weird version of make, which our little replay script would mostly understand, except for one place where it would change in directory, it would understand that, then it would change out of the directory and misparse where it was changing out to. And so it would just go all the way up to slash, so it would go up to the empty string, which is slash. And as part of this process, they would delete their temporary files, which this would replay. And then also, he was running as root. So that was, my students still make fun of me for this stupid approach. So the right solution, it's this funny, I'm sort of an expedient hacker, and like guys there like Andy Chow are sort of do the right thing type people. And so it's very interesting to me when you want to do the gross thing and then the right thing. This turns out you can do the right thing, and it actually is pretty nice. So Andy, I think, came up with this, or Seth. So you just kick off the build, and you just intercept all the system calls. This is sort of like strace. So you see exactly the exec Vs, you see exactly the change dirs, you see exactly all this. Again, I'm just using Unix since we sort of understand what it is. Of course, Windows does all sorts of crazy stuff. But anyway, you see exactly what's going on, exactly the command lines. You know the compiler, the absolute path, the version, the option, the environment, everything. So this is the way you want to do it. And this is, looking back, this is probably the most important thing we did that was successful. We were always, you know, little techno heads. So we thought, oh, the analysis, we have really cool analysis. You know, we're doing really neat stuff. And it turns out probably in the early 2000s, nothing had really been checked. So any stupid thing you did would probably find a lot of errors. And so it's mostly the fact that you could go into some company cold, touch nothing, and see all their code. Because anything you did at that point, you were going to find some good stuff. You know, assuming you had a reasonable tool, which was actually not that hard to build. Later on, the analysis gets more and more interesting. But maybe initially, we could have just had this and nothing else. I don't know. It turns out this is not perfect either. One is, so you have to be able to type a string, like cuv build and then the build command. And it turns out if the guy you're working with is called a build engineer, this is not just a polite, this is not just some weird term. It actually just means, you know, he does not know how to program. So now that this is their job, and what with this one company we're at, his job was push this button when someone tells you to build something. So if they can't find a command prompt, you can't actually run this kind of thing, and that's actually kind of a problem. So there's a set of these stories that only happen in company land. People, there's certain things you're willing to do for money that you're not willing to do otherwise, and this is one of them. So in Windows, there's not really a nice like strace thing. What a surprise! But what you can do is use the debugger to sort of hijack what's going on. And so we did this, and unfortunately, it turns out that there's a certain Microsoft compiler. It's like Visual Studio 2003 something. Doesn't matter what it is. What matters is that a lot of people use it. And it has this use after free bug, which usually doesn't matter. They corrupt memory, then they exit. That's fine. It turns out if you run it in a debugger, which we have to do, then it crashes explicitly. And so Scott McPeak was sitting in this sterile little room, lots of pressure to produce. Suddenly things just start crashing left and right because no one else had used this one little construct with that compiler before. And it turns out after groveling through the hex, what's going on is this compiler checks a flag when it's running. If it's in debug mode, it's malloc and free switches to a debug malloc and free. So when you free it, mem sets it to some funny little character value, which causes you to crash. Which, once you know it, is not particularly helpful because it still crashes. So actually, does anyone figure out what the solution is? What's the grossest thing you could imagine doing? Oh, ooh, that would be tricky. Yeah, I don't know about changing the hex string. Well, what you do is you see where the compiler checks to see if it's running into bug mode, and you smash it with a zero. And that's your solution. And that's being shipped. I mean, it actually works. So there you go. And I'll spare you the Java things. It's basically a recapitulation. Not very interesting. Okay, so second law, which also seems like a banal tautology that you shouldn't even have to talk about, is you can't check code, you can't parse. And this is like saying you ran out of ones and you can't run your computer program. And this turns out to be actually really important. We burn a lot of people on this. And the reason this is important is because there's this myth that the C language exists, which of course it doesn't. The language is not a compiler. What does exist is whatever your compiler eats without giving an error message. And in fact, if it eats it without giving an error message, that in almost everyone's mind is a certification that that is C code. It ended in a dot, the file ended in .c and my compiler ate it. That's C code. And so you have to eat it too, which again, in the lab is fine. You deal with GNU C or whatever and then you're good to go. When you start dealing with all these bizarre little idioms, it gets much, much worse. So for instance, there's a bunch of amplifiers. One is the embedded guys, who you really like, because people don't like it if their toaster crashes. So the embedded guys know, oh, bugs are bad. We will pay you to make a bug go away. On the other hand, for them, space is a premium. So whenever you care about space, immediately there's all these language extensions everywhere. And so they'll do all these things. And the basic dynamic is they'll do something that's completely illegal. It's not C. It's in a .c file. Your compiler hits it, and it's going to give an error message, and it's going to stop. Or it's going to try to go a little bit further, and then it's going to stop. And they're going to be unimpressed completely because you can't even parse my C code. How are you going to find anything interesting at all? You have further things. Microsoft, of course, who are very successful, but they still view standards conformance as probably a competitive disadvantage. Maybe they don't first order go about this, but they certainly don't whine or avoid it if they need to. And then the C language, C++, of course, is a language standard in terms of kilos. There's basically this law, which is what a compiler can parse will be written pretty promptly. Given enough monkeys. So before I did computer stuff, I was a failed linguist, and there's a sort of disreputable hypothesis, the strong Whorfian hypothesis, which was something like, your language determines what you can think. So if your language does not have a way to express some concept, you won't be able to think in that concept. And this is sort of discarded along the way. It turns out the inverse is true with very big teeth, which is that if your compiler does accept it, it will be written, given enough people, and it'll be written pretty promptly. So here's a pretty common sad storyline. Since we're in the summer blockbuster era, this will not net you much. You'll have a core header file, main header file, included by every single file in that whole system. It's going to have some completely illegal C construct. It's going to be included by everybody. It's going to be fed to your tool, which will, every time it sees one of these, give it a little parse error. And people are just like, you know, you people are idiots. You know, you can't even parse C code. Go away. Don't waste our time. You know, so how bad is this? Or what are some examples? So we can templatize it. So this is the first one. We still thought it was funny. You know, why would people do this? That's kind of weird. So the big networking company, you probably run this on your laptop, actually. There's a header file, it has foo, it has int A as a formal, A is a great name, I'll use it twice. You know, it's clear what it means, it doesn't matter. It's not C. Any C compiler besides theirs you feed it to, it's going to blow up. And so they want you to deal with it, but they won't let you change. I mean, if you could change this, that's great. No, can't touch it. So there's you know, redefinition. Here's another one, void X. It's not known. that's the right error message. turns out this is actually in an embedded system, and they want a label that they can refer to get a sort of a location in their data segment, but they don't want to use any space for it. So again, the embedded guys, you gotta love them. So here, you know, this is software engineering. So there was some mention of software engineering helping security. You know, this helps readability. invalid suffix. So you've seen, you know, pound define, typedef, accepted. This is legal in this compiler. You get these other weird ones. Yeah, the embedded guys, again, they're great. Let's see. Oh, and then of course ASM. You know, non-surprisingly, ASM is crazy. The bad thing about it that if there's any place you're going to put ASM, it's in some library function you need to run really fast, and if you put it there, you probably want it inlined, and if it's inlined, it's probably in some key header file, and oh yeah, you can't touch it. So you've seen this movie by now, but you'll see it a couple more times. And then if you can do it for ASM, you can also do it for C++. So there is an extension, C++, where you just take a perfectly innocent C file and eviscerate it with some random C++ crap, and then turn it off. and they do it on purpose. Our tool is unsound. It was always unsound. It was unsound at the point, you know, if you couldn't understand a file or a function, you just discard it. It's gotten even more unsound. So if your tool, our hack for if you can't handle a legal construct, we actually just throw in a regex that rips it out. So like pragma asm gets replaced with if zero endif, and So this was a late-night hack at some big customer site. Well, at that point, not customer, very dubious people. And it's actually stuck around across a lot of stuff. And I'm actually a little, as much as I love unsound hacks, I'm still a little surprised about this. But that's what you wind up doing. And then Microsoft does some crazy stuff. I won't talk about it much. One of their hacks for pre-compiled headers is you can just include something, and then everything up here is ignored. And so since it's not checked, people write all sorts of random stuff there. None of it is going to be C code, and all of it's going to give you an error. So you have to know about this weird Microsoft VM, and it gets worse, which I will spare you. So part of science is measuring stuff. So here's some coefficients on how much C doesn't exist. So where we start from is probably where, if you check C, you probably start from the same place we do, is you just talk to EDG guys and license your front end from them. So pretty much everyone uses these guys. They've been around since 89. They only do front ends, and they look like people that you only do front ends. And they really are careful about this. So they're aggressively supporting GCC, Microsoft, everything. So not only feature compatible, but if you want to see what people will do for money, you just sort of surf through there looking for ifdefs. They're actually bug compatible. So there'll be things like, you know, if this is Visual Studio 2.4.3, there'll be a little comment. Well, they mess up this one construct in this way, so we're going to mess it up in exactly the same way. It'll be like a huge chunk of C code to do this. So if anyone is going to be able to eat all the different dialects out there, it's going to be these guys. And it turns out that it's hopeless, very far. So once we got this, you shove a couple billion lines of code through, and then you wind up with this stuff. So there's 406 places. We did a recent couple week ago grep where there's like an ifdef covariity, where even after all this, it wasn't enough, so they went and they hacked it themselves. There's a whole bunch of weird compiler flags you have to use where things just don't work. And then for supported compilers, there's still that ugly ifdef hack, and this is roughly the lines of code for each one. So MetroWorks is kind of crazy. It's like 1,600 lines of code of ifdefs, Microsoft, as you would expect. Everyone else is, you know, it's in the hundreds. And this is after all this. And this is one of those, it's completely unbelievable to me. We are actually burning really, really smart people on our, this is their job. And they're actually really good people. And there's a team, their morale is maybe what you would expect, but there is a team, and they've been there for a while. And when I made this slide, I just grabbed through, and they're not done. They're never going to be done. So when I made this slide, I grabbed through the trial reports from the past couple days, immediately found these two places where some guy had to hack some if-defs in there because they weren't already handled. And again, if you don't handle this, you get nowhere. You get no sale, nothing. And it's just one of those things. It's just not interesting, but it's first order. And I never would have guessed that that was one of the issues. And then, of course, anytime there's something annoying that you don't like that you have to solve, there's always amplifiers. So one of them here is you can never get the source code. So you sign NDAs, doesn't matter. Even if it's just a stupid parse error, you know, just let me cut and paste these 10, you know, two lines. No, type it from memory. Even for pre-processed. Though this might be, for bigger companies, this is maybe not such an issue. I mean, Coveri is still probably too small for it to be worth their while to sue. So they couldn't see getting the money back if necessary. But maybe if we were bigger, they'd be more willing. So the sales guy types it in, works as you would expect. It's really bad for performance problems. So, you know, the dollars get much bigger when you're talking 30 million lines of code, and that's, of course, when all your little, your little algorithms that had an exponential worst case, you know, you show that workload through, you're going to tickle them, and then suddenly you can't type in that to get it, and then you usually, it seems to be, there's various natural constants, which are, I can't really explain, but one of them seems to be you get three tries to fix anything. You know, they'll do some random thing you ask them once. If it doesn't work, they'll maybe do it again, and then you get one other try, probably involving your CEO, on some, you know, very loud, angry, yelling conference call where you ship people. And then, of course, if you add a three-letter acronym, things get worse. So NSA, you know, not only can they not, you cannot see the source, the engineer never sees it in the first place, so can't even type it. So you have some guy that's not really technical on the phone with you trying to describe what's going on. And, you know, that's if you write novels, that's probably good for some dialogue, but if you're trying to make a sale, it's probably not very helpful. FDA, FAA, these guys have this really horrible dynamic, which is anytime you change the tool chain, because they're so conservative, it makes it worse. It really ossifies the tool chain, because anytime you change it, you have to recertify everything. So people change nothing ever, both you and the other people. So what you get are these compilers that are 20 years old, and you have this stupid problem. Is that, how do I get a license for like Borland 0.003? It just doesn't exist. I cannot do it. So we literally have people that go on eBay looking for these things. And this is actually where you get them. Because you need the compiler, because otherwise you can get these errors and you can't replicate them at home because there's nothing to feed it to. And unless you have this, you can't play. And then it's also bad for you because if they do buy, and they may have a lot of money, they're not changing your tool for the next 20 years. So 20 years from now, there's some retarded bug in your tool that you hacked up late at night and you're supporting workarounds from it 20 years from now when you're ready to retire and you can't even quite remember what's going on. So this is a sharp knife. There's no handle. It goes both ways. All right. So the end heuristic, and then we'll be out of this. If you've heard of it, you're probably going to support it. If you thought it was dead, you're probably going to support it. If you haven't heard of it, you're going to learn of it. One of my favorites was this compiler development company / photography company specializing in animate. So normal distributions hold everywhere. So this is one of them. This is 6 standard deviations. I don't know if it's plus or minus, but specialized in anime and science fiction, fantasy convention photography, and other costuming. We also do on-location photo shoots and compile some dialect that we claim is C, which of course isn't. And you better figure out what it is. Okay, so here's... I'll now switch gears a little bit, putting some coefficients on some other stuff. Actually, are there questions so far? Just start interrupting at any random place. Or not? Okay. So... maybe there'll be a small lag. All right, so first question, you know, do bugs matter? And this is like, huh, you know, why are you even asking about this? And it turns out the answer is no to some people, and you'll run into them pretty often, surprisingly. So the very, very, these trials, they start, the prefix of the trial is like your dream. You find like these horrible crash bugs, obvious, you know, they freeze something, they use it. So there's like some big security violation. You say, look, they do this and this, and it's really bad. What do you think? And they're like, yeah, that looks pretty bad. And it's like, oh, well, what's going to happen? And, well, we'll get a support call. It's like, don't you care? No. There's two things going on. One is a little bit technical, which is that there do seem to be a lot more people doing these deployed distributed systems where you can sort of do phased rollout where half your DNS entries resolve to one set of machines, the other half resolve to another. So if you make a mistake, you just flip back to the old version. So it's not like you have to recall boxes. So that, maybe it's not as bad. The other is that it depends on who finds it. So if QA can't replicate a bug, it didn't happen. The tree did not fall. It's not my problem. So the very lazy sort of approach. But you know, you still, you know, late at night you struggle with this. It's like, well, you know, bugs do matter, don't they? And it turns out, yeah, you know, to some number of people. But not if there's too many and not if they're too hard, which I'll get at a little bit later. Or now.
Go back to the first bullet point.
Sure.
So why are they paying you to do this?
Oh, this would be during the first trial. So somebody at the company thought it would be cool if you came in because it's free and you know you're gonna run on their code and show them some bugs. So you want the bar as low as possible so you can get in. And then, you know, it's low. So there you go. and then the next step is, you know, even if, at least at this point, they agreed it was a bug. The other is that, you know, that's not even a bug. Because it turns you report these things, then they have to get it. They have to recognize it. And it turns out that there's a lot of cubicles and not too much IQ sometimes. Yeah. Hopefully not. Maybe they do. Oh, sorry. The question was, if they have important code, are they running on the parts that don't matter? People will, for a trial. Well, people in general will just do whatever you can imagine. But I think in that case, you'd be fine if it's really important and they know. So what you love is these companies that have monetized time between crash. If like someone's bonus is tied to time between crash, they get it. You know, you don't have this kind of weird dialogue stuff going on. If they think it's probably good because they read in a paper and, you know, well, let's see what you got, then, you know, there's going to be some number of people there that maybe just don't care. But, yeah, you're right. You don't want them running on a testing code because that's just going to be a big pain in the ass.
Your company seems like it's expensive.
Yeah, oh, yeah, and that's the other thing. Right, I'm sorry, I don't quite understand. So our company is expensive, so they'd have to really care about bugs.
No, they really care about, they have some programs that they really care about.
Sure.
But they don't want you to see, so during trial,
they might.
That you can see.
Right. So that does, I mean, that happens with government sites. It seems to happen less at companies. I mean, usually the system's pretty big, so you can't, I mean, so you saw 1,000 lines? Yeah, good luck. I'll show you all of it to you. Yeah, you tell me what it does. That probably does come up somewhat. It doesn't seem to come up all that often. But getting them to run on the right code is definitely an issue. But usually it's not by intent. It's just like, I don't know why they had us check this thing when they really care about this other thing. It made no sense. And they, in retrospect, wish that we checked the right thing. Okay, cool. Any other questions? All right. So here's a bunch of false positives to some group of people. Usually people think these are bugs. So the first one, normal distribution. You see enough people, they're going to be six standard deviations. Turns out the far end is kind of amusing. So this one, this is a great dead code bug. They set I to 1, they check I is less than 0. You know, it's like this whole loop. You wrote this loop, it can't execute. And the guy looks at you, he's like, no, it's a loop. You know, it runs at least once. It's a loop. No. Then you get these funny postmodern views of what you should do. So here we declare three variables. We memset, this is on a 32-bit machine, memset it to 12 bytes. So that'll be 2 bytes to the 8 bytes here and then 4 of here. So usually people think it's a buffer overflow. It's like, I meant to do that. They're next to each other. This is faster. Okay. you know, you free foo and then they use it. Well, there's no malloc here, so I'm okay. It's like, well, just, did you not need it? Why did you do this? Then the last one, which comes up seems to be every 13 months, this weird Kakadian rhythm thing. So they had this thing, 4-byte element, P, they do P4, of course, see is zero length array, zero based arrays. This is one past the end. It's like, no, 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 answer lets you go one past the end of the array. It's like, no, no, it doesn't. It's four. You said four entries, and you went to the fifth one. No, no, it does. And you just, we'll agree to disagree. It's no, you're wrong. They pay you. I cannot believe this. I know what to sell in my stock portfolio. And then this is actually, this is mildly amusing, but it's actually a little bit, slightly more pervasive. So when we started, we thought we were going to be the idiots, which in some ways we were and still are. But at least our naive expectation was that people who wrote codes for money would understand things. You'd be pretty good. I mean, you got a real paycheck. You're not like us little grad students or assistant professors and, you know, on these poverty wages. You know, you actually play the game for money. You know, you must be in the valley, you know, of all places. You know, you must be getting somewhere. So, but you'll run into these people, you know, how does your system work? Well, I don't know. I push this little button to do build. It's like, well, we need more than that. You know, or is this a bug? It's like, well, I'm just a security guy. I'm not quite sure about that one. Or you show them a bug, and they're like, oh, yeah, that's a bug. But that's in third-party code. It's like, no, it's going to crash your system. It's, you know, failure is not modular. You know, I don't know if there's a leak. The guy left a while ago. I mean, it's surprising. People just don't understand compilers. You know, we used to, not as much now. Things have changed. But initially, you talk about these, you know, we use compilers and static analysis. They're like, well, how many test cases do I need? I mean, I got a big code base. It's like, no. Can I use my test cases? No, not really. You don't need them. Oh, so I can't use them. you know, this business card the guy gave to one of our guys, he's looking at it, you know, proper noun, static analyzer, which I'm not even sure what that means. I'm pretty sure he doesn't either. Anything that finds bug is testing, and eventually you just dumb it down. It's like, oh yeah, just think of it as super compiler warnings. That's all it is, super compiler warnings, and you'll like them. So in general, there's a lot. Oh, I'm sorry. Hey, Tal. They often just don't care. It's at least for. So I know there are other people that are doing things a different way, but at least for us, it was always hard to do a security sale. It was we find lots of bugs. Oh, and by the way, here's some security ones. Because there'll be whole sites that just, you know, embedded guys could care less, whether they should or not. And it turns out often security groups, there was two bad dynamics. One is they often, it was sort of big hat and no cattle, like they, or I don't know, maybe the reverse. They had a mandate and no budget, so they couldn't actually purchase. Or if they, the bad thing, which is not just true here, was that you didn't want your tool to be shelfware, especially if it was expensive. And so you always wanted the user to be the buyer, because then if they got a, you want the person who can use it to be the one that gets embarrassed if it sits on the shelf. So then you never wanted like there to be a security group that bought it, and then they have these other people that have to use it, and the other people looking at the security group like, yeah, whatever, go write some code. And so it would often be a shelfware type thing. I think other people have different experiences than us, but at least the way that we approach things, we ran into this often. Because, yeah, it was great. Like, security bugs, if anything, seem like we found more of them. Like, you know, if you acquire a lock and release it 100 times and it was never checked, probably you mess it up at least once or twice. And then if there was a security thing, you would see these vast swaths of code where the guy just didn't even know that this was a rule. And so they just violated it every single time. So you had these, you know, really sweet bug counts. And it was quite hard for us, at least for many companies, to get them to care that much, unfortunately. But this is maybe not universal, so I'm not making any universality claims. Yeah, that's. Oh yeah. So if you can launch an exploit that blows them up, yeah, they tend to pay attention. But even then, they not. But yeah, actually, so that's part of the why we're working on the current research we're doing at Stanford, which is symbolic execution to generate that kind of stuff. Because exactly this type of dynamic, it's much sexier if I just send you a packet and you blow up, and I say, well, you know, maybe you should fix this problem I found for you, or not. I don't know. And other people do the same thing. It's not just us. I think there was one other question, which I lost in the bright lights.
It was just a comment.
As long as it compiles, it can ship it. Yeah. Okay. Absolutely. All right. So a general problem you have is cluelessness, not just your own. Other people, and they have money, and you want it. So you try to figure out a way to deal with that. And the trouble is you can't really argue. So if someone's really smart, they know it. If someone's kind of dumb, they usually know it and you can win. If they're really dumb, then it's like it wraps around and they think you're the moron. And so arguments just don't go very well. So what you do is, again, you resort to these normal... One hack is to resort to normal distributions. You try to have a larger meeting for these results. And usually the larger it is, the more likely there's like some smart people, or at least people who care about bugs or can diagnose the error. Maybe they wrote the code, they've been burned by a similar error, and they'll be able to beat up on these people. Because if once you're the antagonist, it doesn't work very well. Sometimes you may get away with it, but usually if there's any sort of argument, you want it to be internal, so you're not the bad guy. There's other hacks you can do is when you get the results, geeks like to look smart, so you take one of them aside and you explain how things are going and like maybe some of the bugs to them really quickly, so in the results meeting when people don't get it, they can pipe up and say, no, this is how it works. And then they're very happy and this is great. Another thing you want is as you get more people, the chance that they're one of them is in another group goes up. So this is good because then you can sell to one group and then sell to another. And then there's this case where sometimes things in the business world, which normally would be bad, are actually good. So the larger this is, the probability that you throw a pink slip dart and you hit one of them, you know, later goes up. And so it turns out, as an example, if you sell a tool to a company and people get fired, it's not always a bad thing from an amoral business perspective. So there was from a human perspective, it's maybe not so great, but just from business, it can be okay. So there was one example. They did a sell, and then a week later, the company fired 110 people. And we're like, oh, this is not the best press. I mean, buy software quality, fire 110 people. And it turned out they actually, can anyone guess why this might be a good thing? Yeah. So these people, I mean, it turned out they were not all bad, and they sort of spread out to these other companies. And we actually got 4 other sales because they had seen this. They sort of liked it, and they pulled them in for a try. And so, yeah, from a morality perspective, it's a little sketchy. From a straight business perspective, it's a little surprising, but observed. Okay. This is the part I can't comment on, I think. Not allowed to name competitors, not allowed to, yeah, anyway. So the other thing, this is a naive thing we had in school, was that, you know, you find a bug, you go fix it, obviously. Or maybe you're busy, but you try to fix it, and you really care. It turns out that there's a magic number, which seems to be around 1,000, where if you find less than 1,000 bugs, people actually will go fix them all. Often that you can sort of rely on it. But if it's more, then there's this weird thing they do, which is called baseline. And it seems like all these big companies rediscover this concept on their own. And I was really shocked when I saw it. And then after the 10th time, you get less shocked. And what they do is they say, okay, well, there's too many bugs. We're not going to fix them. But by God, we want no new bugs. So we want to track those old ones, and then we're just going to make sure that things get better. And so this has some weird things fall out from this. One is that tool improvements now become bad. People will get angry. We had people screaming at us when I find twice as many bugs now. Oh, they're going to love us. Oh, this is like fire and water, and oh, my God, check it out. No, not always. So you're a manager. You want a little, for whatever metric you have, you want it to look like this. You know, you want bad, and you want it to go down, you want time, and you especially want, like, your little bonus thing to be, you know, like, do. You know, no one gets a happy little bonus for something that looks like this. And, I mean, you can make arguments that, oh, the tool is getting better, and you can try to do this, but you're probably not very technical, and your boss almost certainly is, you know, logarithmic of your technical. And so it's really hard to get any sort of, yeah, this looks bad. It's just bad. And people get pissed. Yeah, they will do that. Actually, that's what happens. So how do you upgrade when more bugs is bad? So one is never. So you guarantee improvement. And there are people that do this. Or they renew, but they don't upgrade. So this is expensive, but also improves. Never before a release. Because it's funny. If your tool seems good enough, they use it to gate the release. Now they won't use it exactly when they need it the most in some sense. So this is not so good. Never before a meeting. So if a manager has to present results, they'll never do an upgrade. You know, you maybe get fired. At least this is somewhat rational. What every big company does is they do an upgrade and they do a rollback. to the old version, and then they fall in one of these other buckets, which everybody seems to independently discover. What they tend to fall into is this sort of once-a-year thing. Once a year, you'll go through the work of rebaselining. On the other hand, what's happened is that it's gone a couple more versions by now, so now the bug count is even higher. This is the deal with the devil. Or what people will often do is there'll be like three checkers, maybe not the checkers you would pick, but the checkers that they pick, where they fix all those bugs, and then the other ones get baselined. So they do weird mixes. I'm being unfairly pejorative in the sense that if you have enough bugs to be 1,000 or more, then in some ways it actually is rational to baseline, in the sense that if you had that many bugs, you probably had a very large code base, and the only way you could have a large code base is probably if it's very old. And so it's sort of working. So if you go and you fix stuff, you might actually break it worse, or you might perturb something. So just leave it well, or the people who wrote it are gone. Or there's all these other things where you just say, okay, we're not going to touch it, but if any new bugs, we'll go fix those. And so it actually is more rational than I was saying, one could argue. So this is just to make it a little bit more concrete. There was one guy, he was a great guy, great manager. They ran 2.4. They went from 2,400 errors down to 1,200, so they actually fixed over 1,000 errors, which is sort of unusual. Then he upgraded, bumped up, and he got pissed off for both reasons. So one, you undid all my work. Really mad. And then two, how could you miss all those bugs the first time? Oh my God, wait, what does this mean? And you will often see this. It's like, well, how you found the, oh God, how are we gonna, what are you missing? How are you sure? Okay, so false positives, it's a little bit more straightforward. So false positives, yeah, roughly speaking, are bad. Roughly speaking, above 30%, you probably start to have a real problem. People either ignore the tool, or they miss true errors because there's just too much garbage. You just totally miss things. What happens, which is really frustrating, is once you lose trust, it gets bad quickly. Because once I lose trust in your tool, you show me something complicated, you just mark it as false positive. And then I lose even more trust. And you see this over and over again, which is, it's a pretty harsh filter on the type of analysis you can deploy. You can't let your bugs be too complicated, which I'll talk about a little bit. The current deployment religion is should not be above 20% before the code ready guys will release, which is where they've wound up. Other people might have other thresholds. Security guys seem really forgiving about false positives, but other people seem a little bit worse. One caveat is, even though I said false positives could be high, one thing we didn't do, which I think you probably could do profitably, is the only thing you really need are good bugs. So the other way, if you have a really noisy checker, what you can do is you just wrap a person around it and you ship that, that little system off. And so the stream of errors you see mount is high quality, but you've had to filter them beforehand. You probably could actually have a successful company that way. So this is a little bit oversimplistic. It's also oversimplistic in the case that many high false positive rate sites, once you have good analysis, it's no longer an analysis problem. This is one of the things where my biases will probably make you somewhat skeptical, but at least talking to the developers we have that work pretty actively, like Scott McPeak remarked, the last four or five, two high false positive sites he saw, this false positive were fine, it's just the people didn't understand the checker. And so they misdiagnose everything. They just totally don't get the point. And so they mess everything up. And so once you're in that land, it becomes harder to see what to do.
How about putting a dial that allows people to turn up or turn down?
Oh, that would be wonderful. I'm a big fan of that. So this is one of the many things that in my view, they've actually regressed from what we knew how to do about 8 years ago. And in their view, they think I'm an idiot and you can't make that stuff work. So one thing we used to get really worked up about was ranking. You try to rank from most important to least important or most probable to least probable. And it turns out that's not as entirely straightforward as you might hope, because people want to see all the errors, or they get really confused. What does that mean? And actually, I can't even tell you. it's weird arguments.
Well, the part is why, going back to the previous slide, you said,
Yeah, but they do get worked up about missing stuff then.
Yeah.
Even though they're not fixing it, and unfortunately I can't give you a good answer. I'm puzzled myself. This is something I'm actually actively having an argument with about right now. Talk. Yeah, so currently the bias... Yeah. The trouble is, there's this thing. You sort of want one size fits all because that's simple, you can explain it. On the other hand, you want the dial, but the dial turns out to be complicated to explain and actually complicated to implement. I think, I'm not saying this is, again, the one true way, but currently the bias is they'll do analysis hacks that will eliminate false positives at the expense of false negatives. But it would be nice, indeed, to have a dial where you could go the other way, especially for security people. They just want to see everything. So other point, all false positives are not equal. If your first three bug reports are all false, that's bad. You just get rejected out of hand. What you really, really don't want, if you have a complicated false positive, it can be okay. If you have a really retarded false positive, that's really bad. You don't want anything embarrassing. You really don't want anything that will fit in a punchline. Because if you're charging a lot for your tool, that means that the person who did signature authority is probably pretty high up. Anyone high up has enemies. Any enemies that have this wonderful thing that fits in an email subject line or, you know, pretty quickly in the email are going to use it. And they're going to use it pretty hard and quick. And he's going to get really, or she will get really embarrassed. And that's not so good. So the false positives are very much not all equal. Legitimate ones you can argue about. Okay. All right, so I'll get moving a little bit quicker. So you start getting some funny answers to some fairly simple questions. So there was this initial trial. They ran it. They found 700 errors. Well, errors. It turned out there were some problems in the analysis. They fixed them. They got rid of 300 false positives. This is like, oh, this is great. You know, we're so much better now. Turned out the company wanted to rerun before they bought. And so suddenly their 700 reports went down to 400. So you were stuck in this place where either you lost 300 bugs or your tool sucks so badly you had 300 false positives to begin with. And it turned out they didn't like either answer that well. All right. So I'll start skipping forward a little bit. The other is, you know, false negatives matter. So initially we thought, oh yeah, false negatives, invisible, who cares? So it turns out that initially some people would see bugs in the trial, and then you didn't find them, and that's not so great. It turns out that people don't do that so much anymore. I'm not quite sure why. But what often happens is the easiest sale you get is there'll be some company that got burned by some horrible bug last week, and by God, they must, you know, never happen again. And so they'll run you on last week's version, and if you find it, that's a sale. You know, whatever the price is, whatever, at this point people are engaged, it's good. This is like the easiest thing you could ever do. If you miss it, some of these things get negated, and it's not quite so nice. So this is bad news, especially if it's fairly simple. The worst thing, though, is that when you upgrade a checker, often the way the analysis decisions interplay with the real source code changes, and so your set of defects fluctuates. So you'll find some more bugs, you'll lose some bugs, and it's a little bit noisy. And this is a problem because people know in theory that you're not a verifier. If you then go and drop 100 bugs that they knew about and they're no longer there, then they really know you're not a verifier, good and hard. And they get pretty nervous and not so happy. All right. So I will... Well, very quickly I'll go through this. So this is a continuing source of frustration where there'll be some very simple, clean, elegant hack you can do to solve some problem like exponential paths. And because of social factors, you can't use it. So the biggest one I know of for us, other people probably have other ones, is non-determinism. So whenever you have exponentials in academia, you just do some randomized thing. You know, it's going to work pretty good. You'll make progress. Or, you know, if worst case, you'll do a timeout. So randomization plus timeout, you know, you probably cover most things that work. And unfortunately, it doesn't work very well in tool space because people really want the same results from run to run. And this is true even if they change the source code base, even if they upgrade the tool. Their model is, you know, you're a compiler, you found bugs, your compiler warnings, my compiler warnings don't fluctuate, yours shouldn't fluctuate either. So classic determinism, same input, same function, same result. Here, different input, which is the changed code base, different tool, different version, better be the same result. And this really, I mean... Yeah, it really sucks. If you do Stirling of that, it's pretty short. If you do the actual implication in reality, it's pretty big. Because often you'll make these tool changes and they'll have pretty unclear implications. So there's always this nagging feeling that something's going to happen to you. And you no longer can do randomization. And I will actually skip ahead. So we do some caching. It turns out this is really a problem. I'll just give you the high bit. we do caching to deal with exponential paths. The problem with here is that if you do minor changes to the tool or to the code, you get different cache hits, which means that your code gets pruned. So this is just as a true story, very quickly make things work. So version 2.0, you get to an if statement. You have two paths you have to follow. You could do true, then false, or false, then true. So initially we did true, then false. Version 3, for some reason, it was a little bit nicer to do false than true. The errors fluctuated by 20%, literally. You know, you lost 20%, gained 20%. Still not quite sure what happened. As you can imagine, people went ballistic. So the solution, as you can imagine, just go back to the old way and not worry about it. So, all right. Okay, so another frustration. Initially thought more analysis is always going to make things better. And it turns out it doesn't. If your analysis is invisible, you can just crank it up to the sky. If you don't have to tell anyone about what's going on, hey, you know, go for it. So things like false path pruning or clever function summaries, all that stuff you can do. The trouble is, if you did some cool little analysis trick to find an error, as we mentioned earlier, whatever that complicated subroutine did, you have to present that to the user so they can understand why do I believe this is an error? You can't just say, oh, bug at line 10. You have to say, well, this happened and that happened and that happened. This is why I believe it's an error. So they have to have some model. So every time you call the subroutine, they have to do it. They get tired. The more complicated the thing is you do, the more likely it is you mess it up. And the more steps, the quicker they get tired. So what actually happens is a lot of the analysis we knew how to do 8 years ago or so, we don't do anymore because we don't know how to describe it. You can easily find it and describe it to a tool builder. You can't describe it to random people who will not read the manual and will blame you when they don't understand something. Just say, oh, there's too many false positives. So it very sharply, it's a short leash. And this is really deformed what we've done. So we've actually given up on whole error classes. So for a longest time, we did nothing with race conditions. So, you know, maybe one of the best errors you could find, you know, non-deterministic, ugly, arbitrarily bad, violates all sorts of invariants, didn't do anything with them. Because we knew how to find them, didn't know how to describe them. And it was not just us. So the Intrinsic guys in the 90s also had the same problem. They also gave up for the same reason. We're now slowly getting into it, but it's very much a small step, small step, small step. We know how to do all this stuff, not quite sure how to get there. Also given up on statistical analysis. So usually, you know, you have millions of lines of code. You don't really know what it does, but you can infer a lot of stuff. We don't do hardly any of that anymore, just because it's so hard to describe it to people. And for me, I think this is probably the 10x that we're leaving on the table. If someone else comes up with a way to do that, there's probably an enormous amount of stuff you get out, at least in my opinion. This is the thing that actually bugs me the most late at night. All right. I won't... Okay. So... in terms of normal distributions and people doing funny things, it turns out also that not only is more analysis not always good, but the less analysis you do, often the bugs get better. So it's hard to be really, really, really stupid in a fairly harmless way. So probably the best bug we ever found in terms of press releases and all that kind of stuff was in X Windows, where this actually got in Fox News, on the website at least. Not on the O'Reilly factor, unfortunately, which might have upped the information content. So it's this little snippet right here. Actually, does anyone see what the problem is? Curious. No one would ever do this. Makes no sense to even look for this error. Yeah. Yeah. So he's checking to see if you're root or not root. So the first time, you get things right. Second time, leaves the parens off of get effective user ID, which is a function, which, of course, can't be at address 0 on Unix. So this thing always fails, no matter what. So never gets through. They meant to put parens here. So this is something Scott McPeak actually hacked up on his first day at Coverity in, like, 10 minutes because he had nothing to do, so he was going to do something. And this was, like, really stupid, so why not? So it turns out the amount of press, I don't know, there was probably hundreds of little press things coming off that one thing. So we have all this crazy analysis, all this really tricky stuff. Doesn't get any attention. This is like probably a two-line checker. All right. So this was, in some sense, actually wrap this up a little bit more in context. This is, you're looking for so most of the bugs we talk about so far are like sort of violations of logic, of type properties. If you look at violations of logic, so you look for tautologies or things that make no sense or contradictions, you actually tend to find deeper underlying design flaws rather than these sort of low-level null pointer non-release of locks, use of freed memory type things. So probably one of the more serious errors we found was looking for dead code. So dead code has this bad rap of, you know, oh, people just do like if zero and return and stuff that's not interesting. If you look, on the other hand, if you look for dead code where there's some fairly complicated control flow that's not possible. So they wrote a lot of code and it can never be executed because it's fundamentally, the constraints leading there are fundamentally unsatisfiable. You tend to find some pretty interesting stuff. So one of the best errors that tends to be logic errors. So one of the most serious errors we found was at a chemo company. And this is really stripped down, so it's not particularly interesting in its current form. So they have this if statement, tube 0 equals I. You do some stuff. Second if statement, tube 0 equals I. So at that point, that can't happen. And at that point, it can't happen, so it doesn't get run. So you turn out, you use some uninitialized values to dump chemo medicine into someone. Literally, actually. And it's not an easy uninitialized thing. I stripped it down. And this was actually at a company where the guy, his sister had actually passed away because of a chemo software bug. So he vowed this was never going to happen. And this was part of the stuff in his code. So these are people that are pretty serious about what they do. And by looking at logic rather than type errors, you actually can find some more interesting stuff that otherwise you would miss. So actually, he literally ran out there to the meeting to go fix this, which I guess it's just been in the past month, so it hadn't been deployed. I'm sorry? Well, that was like a tautology. Thanks. So that was a case where a simpler checker cherry picks something out, because the dead code bugs they tend to be sweet but complicated, not always the best dynamic. So what you usually do is you might have some checker for a broad error class, and you'll cherry pick the easiest ones to describe out because people will look at those. But yeah, thanks. Okay. So I will speed up. I'll skip all that. All right, so part of this has been about how the social makes the technical suck. Sometimes the technical actually makes the social a little bit better. Not to be too repetitive about this, but one thing that actually has been really nice is that there's a pretty simple message. You know, you can describe it to mom. It's like, yes, we will walk in, touch nothing, find low false positives and good bugs. And if you can describe it to mom, you can describe it to most sales guys or girls. And you can hire from a large class. You can also have a lot of people work as sales engineers and go in there and work. So you've really lowered the barrier to entry. And also you can describe it to the customer. They'll get it. There's nothing really complicated you're describing on the phone. It's like, yeah, we come in, we run, you find some stuff. And it should be good. I'm like, okay, I got that. It's whether I believe you or not. It's not whether I understood you or not, which is a much more difficult barrier. And this is a non-trivial thing in retrospect. One thing that's sort of surprising is people, not many, but some have started using this to do relationship therapy because the tool is viewed as objective. It's actually fairly arbitrary, but they don't see that, so it's viewed as at least a third party neutral. There's a UK company outsources to an indie company. Indie company would always produce stuff that company, the UK company thought sucked and wasn't very good, and they'd fight, and they were gonna, you know, constantly threatening divorce. We're going to go with someone else. We're going to sue you. All this kind of stuff, and then they started using. I'm not sure who came up with this idea, but they started using Coverity as an arbiter. So the rule is, if your code gets through this tool, no warnings, then we'll consider it good code, and we're going to use it. And this is maybe... there's some adjectives for that. But lucrative is one of them. They've actually spent a lot of money, and they're happy. I don't know. This seems to have improved everything, and I'm actually still a little bit in shock. I would not have pushed for this, but they seem to like it. One thing that we've seen, and I think a lot of other people have seen, there's been this massive, massive change in the last 4 years in terms of the market, in terms of how easy it is to sell a static tool, probably a dynamic tool as well. I don't know quite as much, which is that 4 years ago, people didn't get it. You'd have a conversation, you'd say static analysis, they say, huh, you know, test cases, or they say lint, you know, lint sucks. Why are you even bothering me about this stuff? It's like, no, it's not that. Now, you know, there's these nice networking effects. There's so many, there's good tools out there, not just ours, that the probability that, you're talking to someone who's worked at another company that's used it, or knows, has a friend that's using a good tool, or has read some piece where the journalist actually finally understands what these tools can do, just goes up dramatically. And so you no longer have these sort of basic education type discussions. They sort of know what it is, and then it just, again, boils down to whether they believe you or not, or willing, whether they're willing to burn a day or two to see if you're any good. So it's much, much easier to sell tools. And I think you saw a similar shift across the 10 years from the mid-90s when Intrinsa was around, and they really had to fight for like 7 customers to when we started, because it was so much easier. And I mean, I like some things about our tool, but it was not just all the code that we wrote that made it easier. It was, you could see the dynamics where people cared more about bugs. They understood a little bit more. You could actually find some people out there where you could make some progress. So I think this is good news. If you want to start a tools company, it's going to be much, much easier to get traction now. Also, the people who invest understand things a lot better. Just in closing, some commercial experiences from an academic. One thing I always thought you wanted was bad competitors. And, you know, then you look like the rock star. It turns out that's not always. You should be careful what you wish for. One thing you get is that the time of sale is the maximum time for all competitors to do a trial. So if you have a tool, you charge a lot of money, people want to do a bake-off. And if they do that, and there's this tool that seems like it might be really good but has trouble with the build process, they'll sit there and they'll babysit it and nurse it for, you know, months. Or if, you know, the CEO of that company knows the CEO at this company, you know, they're going to kind of push it along for a while. And so you have to wait for the max of everybody to fail before you can actually pull through, assuming you pull through. The other is that if you take an existing customer from a really bad tool, it's actually not always so great. So one is immediately the culture there is probably disdain rather than sort of curiosity. So you're on a very tight leash. You know, any stupid thing you do, immediately you're just like the other tool. And you're gone. Then you also have these weird social processes. So if you have a tool that sort of finds some bugs but is really a problem, people will wrap social stuff around it. You know, wrap people around it, and then this gets ossified in their social structure. And then you have to fit there because people really won't modify process, even as much as it makes no sense. They just won't do it. And so if that's bad enough, it's not so much fun to fit there. Not just to beat up on other people. This actually applies to us. In a sort of just desserts, poetic justice type thing. The process at your early adopting customers is probably pretty bad for you to deal with because your initial tool was not so much fun. So they do some weird stuff. So there's a really good company, brilliant people there, but they used one of the early versions of our tool. So what happens is that there's one guy in charge of the output. He uses all these weird shell scripts to digest the output. Releases it to other people. So it's really hard for improvements to come through that process for various reasons that I won't bore you with. And it's all because our initial tool sucked and now we can't actually fix it anymore. So it's not so fun about how much process bites you. So sometimes bad is good. So some of the best successes were from failures. So there was this one huge company early on. We did, I don't know, it says 15. It might have been like 22 trials across this company. I mean, this is like a year-long thing. There's all these SEs. Everybody was involved. It was like, oh, God, you know, if we get this, this is the thing. Turns out we lost. Didn't get the massive perpetual deal. Sad faces all around. But it turns out since then, we actually made 2 or 3 times the amount of money that we would have charged them for that one perpetual license. Because you've done all these trials. The overall company didn't want it, but all these different groups did. So you sold it piecemeal, and so they didn't get these, you know, big volume discounts. So that was surprising. So I'll skip the VC part. Okay. Yeah, there's sort of random numbers. So pretty common upper bounds. You got to fit within 12 hours or 24 hours. You don't make a sale. Currently, large is around 10 million lines of code. That's when you get you're paying attention. If things go wrong with 1 million, 2 million lines, you're sort of surprised. Can happen, but you're still a little surprised. And well, I'll stop there. Why not? So this is sort of a grim story so far. So if you can't find the code, you can't check it. Can't compile code, can't check it. And these will determine a lot of your life if you're trying to do a commercialization, at least if you do this type of company. It's not just our problem. Anyone who needs to eat the code to find the bugs has to do all these things. On the other hand, there's a nice little happy dialogue too, which is that if you can find that code and the check system's really big and you can jam enough of it through your tool, you're always going to find lots of stuff. If your tool is reasonable and you don't find lots of stuff, you immediately just go see, how do we misconfigure it? I mean, how could we be missing something? There's no way that this big of a system does not have, you know, thousands of errors. And that's sort of fun. It's still sort of neat to see that kind of thing. But at this point, I guess I'll stop. Let the 4 minutes of questions fall as they may.
It's like awesome. That was great.
Yeah, please.
No, please come up to the microphone.
Oh, useful or practical to provide tools for
to fix bugs?
Yeah. Oh yeah, they would love that. Yeah, you always just show them a bug. It's like, okay, well, why don't I get like a little fix box? I want like the ABC fix box that I click on. I'm sorry?
You can actually suggest fix.
Oh, you probably could. They seem to want it. I mean, you get enough bugs, like what the hell am I going to do with those? It takes forever. But I wouldn't mess it up. That would be bad. And they won't forget. Or screen.
I was just going to say real briefly, for fun, have you actually...
run it on itself? Yeah, and it's funny what people do. So we run it on ourselves, and then people will know, oh, it's going to check this kind of construct. I don't want to deal with its bugs, so I'm going to use this other interface that it can't check. Or I'll throw in some switch statements, you know, just...
That's actually not what I was going to say. but that's a good one, though. I appreciate it. No, I was just wondering, do you guys, versus the sandbox developers versus... those who are CMMI rated, do you notice any difference in terms of the quality of code?
I missed the middle part. So sandbox versus the other one?
CMMI, SEI folks who are following a CMMI process.
Yeah, I don't know. No. I'm not as... Anyone who follows any sort of standard, I would be surprised if their code wasn't better than average. Just, they must be able to read. So.
Yeah, it's hard trying... You would think trying to convince management when they say you got like a team, maybe... you know, of a 5 or 10 developers, and you want them to try to follow a process that they say it's just not practical.
I'm not that tied in with the trials these days, but if you want to send me the email, I can try to hook you up with someone who give you a non-vacuous answer. So, hopefully. Is another one?
Any other questions?
Have you seen any trend in terms of these exotic tool chains? Like, is this getting better? Is this getting worse?
Exotic tool chains?
Yeah. Well, just... So many compilers out there.
If anything, it's probably getting somewhat worse. I mean, because those guys want to keep selling their compilers, so they keep putting in extensions. And you know, I mean, the extensions often were there for a good reason. I mean, I did care about space, or I did want to, you know, grovel through ASM or something. So it's not entirely arbitrary. But it's less often that you get derailed. And the ones you don't support get more and more exotic. So in that sense, it's okay. Okay, I guess that's
it. Super fun. Thanks again. Thanks.